I'm John Krall. Coming up on No Limits, we're going to talk about Indiana's homegrown food movement. We're going to talk about why it matters to grow and eat food locally, and just how widespread this movement has become. We'll talk about this with our guests, Tim Carter of Butler University Center for Urban Ecology, Tom England, a chef and an Ivy Tech culinary arts instructor, and Dr. James Howell, Assistant Indiana State Health Commissioner, and as always, you. You can join this lip-smacking conversation by calling us toll-free at 1-866-476-3881, emailing us at nolimits@wfyi.org, or sending a question or comment via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Please do join us for this show. Now, the news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana's homegrown food movement. We are fortunate to have as our guests Tom England, who is a chef and Ivy Tech culinary arts instructor, and on the Dig In Festival board. Tom, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, John.
We also have with us Dr. James Howell, who is the Assistant Indiana State Health Commissioner. Dr. Howell, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And calling in by phone is Tim Carter, who is Director of Butler University's Center for Urban Ecology. Tim, how are you doing?
We're doing great.
That's good. Where are you calling in from?
We're up here at Montreal at an Eco Cities conference.
Oh, lucky you.
Yeah.
One of my favorite cities. Well, we're talking about the homegrown food movement, about why it's important to grow and eat food that is produced locally. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the conversation. Please call us at 1-866-476-3881 or send us an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. You also can send comments or questions via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Tom England, I want to start with you a little bit. Why is it important to eat food that's grown a mile away as opposed to 1,000 miles away? Why does that matter?
That's a really good question. So if you eat food that is consumed locally, you're obviously giving back to the local economy. We know in this state that if you spend $6.50 per week on locally grown food, that it's going to make a $1.5 billion impact on the state. That's a big difference for the state. But there's also a big difference in nutritional value. So if I can eat a vegetable that was picked today or even yesterday, it's going to have a lot more nutrition involved with it than something that has been really 3 or 4 weeks before it gets to the grocery store and is purchased there.
Before we, and I want to pull others into the conversation, but before we move that point, when you say that the economic impact, the one is that sort of a number game? Is there, if sure. Every state were to do that, and were to make a similar shift, would the impact be the same for Indiana, or is, do you see where I'm going with this?
There's a lot of food produced in Indiana, and we can support that amount for sure. And obviously, all the other states are hoping that you're going to purchase just as much from their local state as well. But there is such an abundance of food in Indiana, and people don't realize how much food is being produced that we actually eat instead of just corn, wheat, and soybeans. So it's all really a local food economy that we can just really perpetuate here in the state.
Well, and would it affect Tim Carter? I'm going to direct this question to you. Would the impact be felt, though, since Indiana is to some degree and still an agricultural state and a big farm and food exporter, would the impact be felt, though, if other states were to grow their own food locally? Would that harm us?
It's an interesting question. I think the question of what constitutes local is kind of a really good one, because there are elements of the Midwest and things that neighboring states could do to potentially complement what's going on in Indiana. I mean, when we as the Center for Urban Ecology and the people that we've worked with, we think actually of like hyper-local urban agriculture, which is a slightly, it's a related topic, but it is another area.
What does that mean?
Local food lens is now being viewed more increasingly. A lot more attention is being paid to what can production can be done within the city and not just all within the state.
What do, when you say hyperlocal, could you define that term a little bit?
Well, I just made it up like 2 seconds ago.
Oh, you did? Okay. All right.
Well, that gives you freedom to do that. Is Big City Farms, you know, where they have lots in the cottage home neighborhood where many people who buy produce from them through their CSA program are actually living in the neighborhood. So it's literally, you know, hundreds of meters away from where the food is produced rather than, you know, in the case of the traditional food system, more like thousands of miles away.
And Dr. Howell, are there health benefits or health risks associated with buying food that is grown closer to home?
Well, I think you have to look at risk. There's risk everywhere you go anytime you buy food. I don't think there's any more risk buying it locally produced than any other place. I think one of the things you look at is are those people growing it, practicing good, what we call good agricultural practices to make sure the ground they're growing on is not maybe contaminated with heavy metals or some industrial chemical, that they're using irrigation water that's basically clean, not full of microbes that might make somebody sick. They're using appropriate practices with their pesticides if they're using them, those sorts of issues. And I think it's as long as those agricultural practices are being followed appropriately, everything's fine.
Well, and in listening to you, I'm wondering if in some ways by growing locally, if there is a problem, it's easier to track down what happened. You don't have to follow a trail back through several hands and a thousand miles or 2,000 miles.
Trace back is often difficult with produce because it often changes many hands. Certainly, if you're buying your produce at one location and you know where you bought it, it's easy to trace back to that location. I think there's some very good things about buying food locally. My favorite example of things I think is sort of silly is buying iceberg lettuce grown in California. Basically, you're shipping water from California to Indiana when we could grow some lettuce, maybe not iceberg, but other lettuces just as well or easier here and save all that transportation costs.
Tom England, you mentioned early on before I diverted you and asked about the economic impact numbers,
sure,
that there were significant nutritional advantages. Mm-hmm. to could you talk a little bit about that? What are those advantages?
Sure. We know that the minute you pick something or pull it from the ground, that it starts to lose its nutritional value. So the longer time that it goes from the point you pick it to the point you eat it, the more that nutrition goes down. There's also a lot of talk about how if you grow fruits and vegetables on grounds that have active bacterial soils, that you're going to have a lot higher nutritional values as well. So, you know, when we talk about local, we're not necessarily talking about small farms or big farms, because locally we have huge farms and we have small farms. And we're not talking about agricultural practices when we talk about local. But, you know, in an ideal world for nutritional value, we're going to get something that is from a small farm that's not using harmful pesticides and other stuff on the grounds that are going to contaminate the ground and possibly kill some of those good bacteria in the ground. And that will help to increase the nutritional value in the foods. At Dig In this weekend on Sunday, we're bringing both groups together. We're bringing large-scale Indiana winery, or not only wineries, but agricultural products together with the chefs who prepare them. But we're also bringing really small-scale heirloom varieties of animals and fruits together with the chefs so that you can try both sides of that and really get to know what the difference is between the different sizes and different types of agriculture we have in the state.
We are talking about homegrown food and the homegrown food movement. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Tell me a little bit more about Dig In. Say I am, you know, someone who's listening right now, and I want to take part in it. What do I do? Where do I go?
Sure. Well, on Sunday from noon till 5, Dig In is a festival that really celebrates Indiana food and agriculture. So we are bringing 30 chefs from around the state together with 11 breweries, 10 wineries, Indiana artisans. And so you can pay $20 in advance by going to digindiana.org or at your local Marsh supermarket. And if you don't get it in advance, you can pay $30 at the door. You pay one price, you get in, and all the tastings are free at that point. So you really get a great opportunity to try stuff from many different local chefs and from really around the state, as well as foods from around the state.
Whose idea was this?
Well, you know, this started about 3 years ago. Alice Waters came into town to speak to a group. And we had the opportunity, myself, Neil Brown, and Regina Mihalik, to have lunch with her. And out of a discussion actually with Alice Waters 3 years ago, this idea was developed and has percolated. And last year was the first full-blown festival. And then today, or this weekend, we're perpetuating the festival.
Well, and forgive my ignorance, but mm-hmm. who is Alice Waters? Oh,
that's a great question.
I realize
in the world of chefdom, she's a big name. So Alice Waters, in 1972, started a restaurant called Chez Panisse in Berkeley, California. And back in 72, all fine dining basically was French, and it didn't necessarily use any local foods or no thoughts of what the local food would be. And so she said, this is kind of crazy. We're in the middle of the Bay Area, and there's all kinds of great food and agriculture here. And so her and her chef started going out and visiting some of the local farms and started using local foods back in 1972 in California, and that was groundbreaking at that time. And so she is, I guess, what we'd call the first locavore chef and has since that time. So, you know, when we talk about the farm-to-fork movement and everything, it actually started back in 1972 with her.
Please call us at 1-866-476-3881. Tim Carter, I wanted to ask real quickly, why is growing food locally and consuming food that's produced locally important to the life of a city, an urban area?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of reasons for that, a lot of ways to answer that. I think I'm an ecologist, and we're in the biology department at Butler University, so we take a more of an ecological approach to thinking about it. And but whenever you're looking at that in cities, you necessarily have to include human health and activity within those benefits. And so specifically for why local food is better, you know, it improves both biodiversity of the land, but also community health around that space. I think you can see within cities, especially a place like Indianapolis, where there's a lot of vacant properties, and the potential is really high for those properties, at least in a temporary sense, to be converted into growing food in those areas, you know, with proper practices, obviously. It benefits the community. I mean, it brings people together socially. It gives them physical activity. They're able to get out and work that land together, and there are social bonds that are formed around it. The conference I'm actually attending, someone presented on Paris community gardens and how the benefits that are found within community gardens, in particular within the city of Paris, have really been an opportunity for, in this case, underserved populations to have some community cohesion around this issue of urban agriculture. So there's both ecological and social benefits that are a great opportunity within a city that you might not be able to do otherwise.
Stan, welcome to the program. How are you? Well, we'll go real quickly. I'd like to invite our listeners to join the program by calling us 1-866-476-3881. Real quickly, Tom, what do you try to teach your students in terms of the importance of using homegrown food products?
Sure, that's a great question. So in our classes, the culinary arts program at Ivy Tech, we bring in both the stuff that you might find at your grocery store, as well as the small farmer, the small producer. And the students get to taste them side by side. They get to cook with them side by side. And we do talk about, you know, what the difference is and how it is grown, what the nutritional value is, even the economic impact, again, in using that Indiana food. And, you know, it's really amazing when we start to do this. And you know, there's this misconception out there that if I eat locally, it's going to cost more money. Mm-hmm. And so when we're doing this, the students also do all this costing of everything that's used. So they start to realize, hey, this isn't more. In many cases, it's less costly because, you know, if we eat seasonally, the food is much cheaper than if we try to buy red bell peppers in the middle of January.
Yeah, if we're not shipping water halfway across the country from California. We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We are fortunate to have as our guests Tom England, Tim Carter, and Dr. James Howell. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. We're fortunate to have as our guests Tom England, who is a chef and Ivy Tech culinary arts instructor, and on the Dig In Festival Board, Tim Carter, who's director of Butler University's Center for Urban Ecology, and Dr. James Howell, who is the assistant Indiana State Health Commissioner. Also like to invite you to join the conversation. Please call us at 1-866-476-3881. Stan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks.
And your question?
My question, I really appreciate the conversation. I yearn to have my own garden. I yearn to support local farm, local food. The question is, how do you guys see maybe connecting this local food initiative to a poverty initiative so that those that can't have access to good quality food, and I know one of your contributors just kind of mentioned that, but where is the win-win here to support local food but also to connect it to poverty initiatives as well?
Tim Carter, that sounds like a good question for you.
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of good work going on in the city. One direct point of contact for us is through the Burmese community on the north side of town, where us and Purdue Extension helped them start a farm up there with the idea that it's not only providing food for them directly, but also potentially providing an economic source of income for those members of the community, the immigrant community, who may not have access and find it difficult to assimilate for a number of reasons. I mean, it's a super challenging situation for a lot of these refugee populations in particular, and there's a lot of people doing good work in Indianapolis on that particular issue. Another interesting model that's not fully explored yet is through KIB's Neighborhoods program, and they've done some things with hiring the youth tree team to help plant and maintain trees during the summer, and it's another way that we think we can, this is not necessarily poor folks, but it definitely is youth during the summer that we could help. You could use agriculture the same way, but you could actually sell that produce, and the program could be self-sustaining in that way. So there are a number of initiatives that are going on in the city. Those are just potentially, one is already going on, and the other is a potential near-term solution to help with that engagement process.
So, Tom England, real quickly, let me just ask, how are we getting the word out to people who might otherwise, I mean, I'll be honest, I tend to think of the homegrown food movement as much more sort of a yuppie or, an upper crust kind of approach to things. People, how do you reach maybe underserved populations?
That's a great question. There's a term called food deserts, where people may not have a grocery store near them or access to good local produce. And we try to reach out to those communities to be able to get some really nutritious foods. In Indianapolis itself, there are a couple of hospitals now that are working with this food desert issue. They actually are putting together trucks and loading them up with local produce and going into those communities. And basically, it's a mobile store so that people can come in and purchase those foods. Along with that comes another problem, is that people don't know how to cook real produce anymore. You know, they're used to buying stuff that's already
putting it in the microwave and being done. Yeah,
exactly. And so, you know, several people have gone out into those communities and tried to help them learn how to cook and what really what is nutritious and what's not nutritious, and you know, and trying to make a difference. And you know, the hospitals are really stepping up and taking the lead on that, which is great. I mean, they're losing customers this way, but they're also gaining a very healthy community.
John, can I jump
yes,
in real quick?
Please do, Tim.
Just as a piggyback to that, I think it's super important for us to not kind of impose this local vore idea onto especially communities in need, because there's, you know, like Tom says, if you're not, either you don't know how to cook or maybe you don't have time to cook. You know, there's a lot of other social issues around poverty that you really need to have a deep understanding of before we just go and say, well, just start your garden and start growing things and start cooking with it. I think it's really important to not have a kind of a big top-down effort in that regard. It needs to be generated by those communities, and you can help provide resources for them and expertise and that sort of thing. But I think this idea that if you just kind of, if you grow it, they will eat it, is not one that is
the field of dreams approach to.
Yeah, it's not necessarily all that appropriate in every situation.
We are talking about the homegrown food movement here in Indiana. I'd like to invite you to join the conversation. Please call us at 1-866-476-3881. Marnie, welcome to the program.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good, and you?
Doing well, thank you. Your question, please?
Well, I have two. The first one is, I was wondering if anyone could comment on Barbara Kingfelder's book, Animal Vegetable Miracle, and just the feasibility of doing that, of eating purely locally grown food year-round. And I read the book, and I thought, wow, that was quite an undertaking. I'm sure I would have a revolt in my household if I tried that. And then that was my first question or comment. And then the second one was regarding the yuppie comment.
Sorry.
That's interesting to me because rumor has it that there are homeowners associations who will not allow families to have a garden plot in their yard because it is seen as being undesirable or as an eyesore. And I was just wanting to hear comments on that.
Thank you for the question. Dr. Howell, I'll go to you first on that one. The feasibility in terms of, we'll start with it from diet, and then presumably Tom or Tim can talk about whether it's feasible from an actual growing and producing.
Well, I think that's an interesting approach, and I'm glad you brought it up. You know, only a couple of generations ago, we did do that. Most of us probably grew our own food, preserved it, and depended on what we were able to put up for the winter itself. And you just don't have to go back very many generations. So I think it's possible, you know, and I see more and more evidence of people having urban chickens to have their own eggs. I think there's some things we certainly can do if you have the space and maybe neighbors that are willing and will share your beliefs and concern. And I know folks.
Which gets
here,
to her second point. We will get to that in a moment.
And I know folks in basically center part of town here are just out from downtown who have extensive home gardens. Most of their yard is a garden so that they can generate as much of their own food as they can because they want to do that. I think there's a lot of opportunity to do that, and I think if you're very careful what you're trying to do, certainly you can do it, and certainly you can preserve some of those foods to use in the winter, and it's always great to say, I'm eating my own stuff.
Tom England, how feasible is it from the growing and producing and actually running a restaurant if you were trying to do that?
Sure, that's a really good question. And actually, the Barbara Kingsolver book actually changed my life, sounds funny. But when I read the book, I was like, well, wait a minute, they're living locally year-round? How can you do that? And it started to make me think. And after reading that book, I did become a locavore. And so when I'm at home, and majority of the time, I eat within 50 miles of where I live. And it, as far as she was growing everything as well, which I live in a little tract home. I don't think I'm going to be able to do that, but I do know every farmer that I get everything from that I eat, and I do put up tomatoes and freeze green beans and broccoli, and I live a local diet year round. And when we first started doing this, I went into it with the thought of, okay, maybe we'll make it into part of the year, but it's a 3-year experiment now, and I have given in, and I'm drinking coffee every day, but for the most part, I am following that local diet.
Well, as addictions go, that's probably a relatively harmless one. Right. It raises a question, though. How far away, how close does something have to be considered local, locally produced food?
And for me, it's my definition is a leisurely day's drive. If I can drive to somewhere and drive back in the same day, that would be local. And that, for me, that definition came from Chef Dan Barber, who has a restaurant out in New York. And I was listening to him talk one day, and he was saying that for him, the definition originally was 100 miles. Mm-hmm. And then he found an incredible wheat producer that was making incredible wheats for his breads, and it was 150 miles away. And so he totally changed his definition.
So that he can follow the chain. Is there any sort of academic or scholarly definition out there, Tim Carter, of what's considered local?
Yeah, I think it probably is like what Tom says. It varies on what you're interested in. I know a lot of states will have, it's within the state, but I was down in Georgia before this job, and we were in the northern part of Georgia, and you could easily get something from South Carolina a lot closer than you could from southern Georgia, where a lot of the agriculture activity is. But that physical, the number, the physical miles is one that's typically used. I did want to go back to talk about seasonality. I think one of the reasons that the idea of eating locally all year round is really hard for people to kind of think about or have an idea of is that we don't, if you're not eating local, you don't think of seasons or food coming in season. So the cool weather crops are not something that you typically eat when they're available. You just eat the same thing all year round. And so in order to eat seasonally, you have to understand what's available seasonally and adjust your consumption of those products accordingly for spring, summer, fall, and winter.
We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881, sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org, or send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Seth, welcome to the program.
Hi. I've got more of a comment than a question. I run a small CSA. And
what is a CSA for those?
Community Supported Agriculture.
Okay.
It's a share deal where you buy for a season and you pay one single price, and then you get pickups or delivery throughout the season.
Mm-hmm.
So you get whatever is being produced at that particular week. And I guess my comment would be that I think there's a lot of romanticization of local foods, and I think it's portrayed as maybe easier than it really is. I mean, it's a very time-consuming and difficult undertaking, and one that's actually maybe not as lucrative as some people might perceive. Especially this season has been a difficult season with rain coming early and not coming in July, and so it's a low margins business and one that you gotta kind of keep in perspective. I guess that's my main comment. It's a tough business. You don't make much for every item that you produce, and it's all dependent on the weather. It's all dependent on what Mother Nature provides. So,
well, thank you very much for calling. We'll take the subject up. Thanks. Tom England, you were nodding your head while he was talking. You presumably you have to do this and you have to be committed to it for reasons other than making money, as much money as you can.
Right. Yeah. In the United States, that's for sure. I mean, I think we in the United States are just so used to paying very little for our food that we eat. And by and large, I think the farmer doesn't get paid a fair wage for all of his work that he does, or she does. And it's just amazing. I go to the local farmers markets, and I think specifically of a time that I was talking to a farmer who has eggs for sale. Mm-hmm. And he was selling those eggs for $4 a dozen. And someone came up with a very large coffee cup from a Starbucks and said, you know, how much do you want for those eggs? And he was appalled that he would have to pay $4 for really six meals, but would pay, you know, the equivalent amount for one cup of coffee. I mean, it's really out of bounds what we've decided food is worth.
Well, and we've gotten a question, actually a tweet from a listener who goes by Kane Monster, says, gets kind of to this point, says shipping packaging is included in the price of food. Are there noticeable differences in the cost of local versus imported? Tim Carter, what would you say?
I tend to go back to definitions a lot. So
that's fine.
That's per unit that you'll pay for something. A lot of the environmental costs, for example, are not embodied in the cost of that the product that you're going to buy. So it's really important to compare apples to apples if you are going to do that, and try to account for as many of the externalities, is what the economists call it, for those things that are being shipped, you know, around the world, really, to our supermarkets here.
Well, can we talk a little bit about why we moved away from, as Dr. Howell pointed out, you know, a couple of generations ago, it was common. You would eat what was produced locally because you didn't really have a choice. That if the choice really was eat it or starve. Now, of course, we've moved to a much more diverse system where things are being transported, as Tim pointed out, all over the world. What brought us to that point? Why did we think that was a good idea? Tom England.
Well, that's a really good question. I think that, you know, as an evolution started happening, especially right after World War II, we started to see a lot more of the mass production of foods. And, you know, slowly here in the state, we went from a agricultural community who was producing a lot of animals and different feed for those animals. And now we've gotten to the point where, you know, we've lost all of our fence rows even, and those have been overtaken by the corn, wheat, and soybeans to feed the mass feeding operations, which are all confined into one area. So now with this modern agricultural system, we can put great fertilizers on these corn, wheat, and soybeans, and, you know, grow massive amounts. And then we don't need that pasture land anymore for animals, so we stick them in a large shed and let them grow in large sheds instead of out on the pastures. And you know, we've got refrigerated trucks and things that we can ship things around with now that we didn't have before. So there's a lot of controversy over, you know, is that appropriate for the environment? And you know, obviously, are we producing stuff that doesn't have the nutritional value that we need to sustain ourselves? So when Tim talks about the cost, I mean, we're just not talking about the cost of the environment of you know, flying something or putting on a ship and letting it get here. We're also talking about the cost of Medicare, Medicaid, and just medical costs in general, because people aren't getting the nutrition they need from the stuff that they're getting.
Philip, welcome to the program.
Hello, how are we doing today?
We're doing well. Quick question, please.
Yeah, I was wondering if anybody out there is going to be representing compost tea. It's a great fertilizer that you can make at home. And I was wondering if Alice Waters was going to be there. I heard her interviewed on NPR earlier this week.
Well, thank
you. Really love to meet her.
Okay, well, thank you for listening. We'll get the...
What about where can you get your dirt tested?
Okay.
Heard it before.
Okay, well, let me take the question first on the Alice Waters thing to Tom England, and then we'll see if there's a place where we can get the dirt tested. Thank you.
Alice Waters will not be there on Sunday, but we do have a great speaker series that is happening, and you can go online to digindiana.org to see the full lineup of speakers that we have there.
And Dr. Howell, where should someone go to get dirt for compost tested?
Well, I think one of the first places I would check would be with the county extension agent's office. They can tell you where it's easiest to get it done, give you some directions on how to get it tested and how to interpret the results if you need to have it interpreted.
We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. We're fortunate to have as our guest Tim Carter, director of Butler University's Center for Urban Ecology, Chef Tom England, and Dr. James Howell, the Assistant Indiana State Health Commissioner. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to No Limits, and I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, and your host. We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement today. Our guests are Tim Carter, director of Butler University Center for Urban Ecology, Tom England, who is a chef, an Ivy Tech culinary arts instructor, and on the Dig In Festival Board. You've got a mouthful of a title there, Tom. And Dr. James Howell, Assistant Indiana State Health Commissioner. Dr. Howell, you wanted to make a point real quickly about the thing we were talking about right before the break. About why we moved away from homegrown food.
You know, it became a matter of scale and markets for farmers. When I was growing, my family owns about a 200-acre piece of property. It's farmed in the traditional Indiana corn and soybeans. But I can remember when I was a kid in the 60s that we grew 40 acres of sweet corn. We grew pumpkins. But we had a processing plant in the state that we could market that. Those markets have been lost. So to some degree, it's not grown because there's not a good way for farmers to market it. The other thing that impacts it is, and I hate to say it, is the government farm programs have not included vegetable producers for Indiana. It's been our traditional crops. So we're right now facing a drought, and I'm looking at what I'm getting in the corn and soybeans this fall. I'm going to have some protection with crop insurance. But if I'd had planted that in a vegetable crop, I wouldn't have that protection. So a lot of it is financially for the farmer. What can he safely grow and protect himself financially? Certainly it's difficult right now with the drought to maintain a good vegetable crop because you got to have irrigation water. You got to have some way to manage that. So there's a lot of factors involved with this, and a lot of it's just plain financial.
We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881 or sending us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Eric, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you. What's your question?
Well, I own a small meat processing plant in Colfax, Indiana, Bissell Farm Meats and Processing, and we process all local products, beef on the hoof, et cetera. And the issue that you look at with regard to the food system, it's divided into thirds. From our perspective, a third of your time goes to raising it, a third of it goes to processing it, and the last third is the marketing. And the piece that we found as we did our research was with regard to processing, and I believe the assistant director made that comment. He had a processing plant to take it to, and those processing plants are going away in this country. And, you know, no one wants a beef on the hoof to arrive at their door. They prefer a ribeye steak. And so really the issue with regard to the food, you know, we've talked a lot about the vegetables, but when you look at meat products, you know, it's got to go through a processing facility. It has to be inspected by a state inspector or a federal inspector. And then at that point in time, it has to be, you know, sent out to the customer. So really when you're looking at food, you've got those three perspectives. You've got to grow it, you have to process it, and then you have to market it. And the processing really, truly is the restrictive point in local foods at this point.
Well, and I realize you didn't call in to get interviewed yourself, but why are the processing plants going away?
Well, you know, realistically speaking, it's economies of scale. If I can produce, if I can process 20,000 head of hogs a day, the amount of energy that goes into that goes down, so it's very cost effective. I can have mechanization, I can have, you know, streamline the whole process. But that's why, you know, we have focused plants in certain parts of the country. I mean, 80% of our beef are processed by four processors. And so, but that's why it's an economic perspective, and that's why all the hogs need to be the same size, all the hogs need to be consistent, so the mechanization can be very easy. And so as, you know, as that happens and we have larger systems, energy efficiencies go higher, When you look at a small processing plant, everything's done by hand. Electricity is expensive. I mean, we're out in the middle of nowhere, so we utilize, well, we're not out in the middle of nowhere, but we have propane in lieu of natural gas, and propane follows gasoline prices. It's a derivative of gas. So when you start adding those costs up, it's expensive to run a processing plant. I always like to use the example of my cooler door latch. Is, you know, it's $200 for one latch, and I have four of them per door. And you can just start to add up those numbers. It's just expensive to run a processing plant.
Well, thank you for the call. That's you've given us something to think about and talk about here.
Thanks so much. You guys have a great day.
Certainly. You too. Real quickly, I mean, Tim Carter, I'm going to ask this question to you that sort of jumps off of that. If we value the idea of homegrown food, I mean, the caller made a point here that this is a more complex issue than we would have thought. What sorts of things should we be doing to support the movement?
You know, I'm a big fan of not lumping everyone together in one single category, and there's a lot of trade-offs that people have to make every day. I mean, we have three small kids, and I know that there's a lot of things I would love to do that I can't do because of that reason. So that being said, I think their awareness and knowledge is kind of a big part of it. If you know that there is food available and there are ways that you can get that locally, oftentimes that's a big barrier because of, I mean, I think this point about marketing is really important because, you know, a lot of food products are actually the huge budgets about marketing it to people. And so it's to hide and obfuscate all the other locally grown foods that are out there. I think it's really important to have an educational and awareness thing for the public, and I think that's what Dig In does so well. And I would mention too, we're actually doing an event called FoodCon, which is the first Friday at the Harrison Center, which is another way to get people engaged with the food system, and it's through art and this idea of food. So both of those events will be really great ones upcoming in order to educate people. I think education is a big part of it.
We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You also can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. We've gotten an email from a listener by the name of Christian Peterson, who says that Chef England apparently is a fan of yours, says, I've had the privilege of having Chef England in class. I have a question about the ability of the local food movement to provide food for people in poverty. It's a theme we've already dealt with. And he said he'd also like to mention Indiana's Office of Sustainability, which offers certain vacant lots to gardeners in the community. Are there things we could do as a society or a culture to make basically locally grown food more available to people who are disadvantaged economically?
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, but, you know, I want to include in that point is the education part of it. And, you know, not only Dig In, but Ivy Tech, and we really want to get out in the community and teach people, you know, how to cook and you know, how to access the foods. And, again, I just go back to the point where I'm just stunned sometimes that when I go into the community and the lack of knowledge, the lack of availability of even equipment. So, I mean, many times you'll find families that don't even own a stove. You know, it's a microwave culture in many times. So, you know, it's a matter of getting out and teaching people even how to cook with a microwave to make local produce. You know, and it's a culture shift for sure.
Well, and I guess I'm thinking so far we're talking about sort of private initiatives here where you get chefs and all of that. But historically in this country, we've done things with tax policy to protect industries that we thought were important. Dr. Howell, and is that something we ought to think about doing here?
Well, I think you have to go back and look at neighborhoods that are normally poor, and we think often about the poor living in neighborhoods, and I think in many cases they do. I think we have to start looking at how do we make food available in those communities, because many of them don't have a grocery store. How do we get food into those neighborhoods where the people, it's available for food people to buy? Because some communities, it's very difficult for them to go out and purchase fresh fruits and vegetables, no matter where it came from to start with. But then if you have it available in that community, can provide local food, then you can get them to start consuming it.
We are talking about Indiana's homegrown food movement. Please join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. Kiwana, how are you doing?
Awesome. Thank you for taking my call.
Certainly.
I do understand we're talking about produce, but I have to let you know that I have a lot of frustration when I go into the supermarket.
Kiwana, we're getting some feedback on you. Could maybe you call back or get to a place where we're not getting the feedback?
Okay,
thank you. Appreciate it. Sure. Robert, how are you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing very well. Very well. Your question, please?
Actually, it was just on the points that were being made about getting food into the neighborhoods that are a little underserved and more impoverished. And it was about the comment about the trucks going into the neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those trucks, they're not being fitted with local produce because apparently it's too expensive to get local produce on there, and it's much more cheap to get you know, produce that's brought from anywhere around the U.S., even around the world. So I was just wondering if your guest could comment basically on how we could get those trucks fitted with more local produce.
Good question. Thank you very much for the call. Tim Carter, I think I took you off the line, and really it seems to me if there's a way to do that, it's to create some sort of tax incentive or whatever approach to the problem. Is that a good idea in your view?
Well, I think when you think about tax incentives, the question is where are those funds going and what is it encouraging? And so if you can think about particularly urban agriculture where these lots can actually be used as a community benefit in the short term for redevelopment, so it is providing the social benefit for the city. You can actually really justify the use of public funds to encourage that type of behavior. I would mention too the Indy Parks has just recently started a larger farm on the east side, which is that produce is going directly to gleaners, I believe, and will be distributed through their network. So there's the whole idea of kind of these food hubs and hubs being distribution points. Are one way that you can collect produce from a bunch of different small farms and actually have a more efficient system without having to just do larger scale industrialized agriculture and rely on that.
We have gotten a question from Robert via Facebook, and I should say you can send a comment or question via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Robert's question is, he says, home window hydroponics have been coming back, but vertical farming is coming along so slow. Does anybody know what the holdup is there? And I have no idea which one of you to direct that question to. Tim Carter,
could
you take a stab at that, please?
Yesterday, visited this really amazing. I mean, it's called Lufa Farms, and it's a greenhouse on top of an industrial building. And they actually supply. They have a 1,000 person CSA here. And it's all grown on top of this building, and most of it is grown hydroponically. Some of it is kind of a hybrid hydroponic. It has a little bit of coconut fiber as a growing medium. So, again, it's like reconceptualizing and reutilizing these spaces in downtown, and it's a very high-value parcel that normally would just be a rooftop, and now they're actually using hydroponic technology. And it's a very, very sophisticated system in order to supply locally grown produce to the Montreal area, at least.
Travis, welcome to the program.
Thank you. My comment is about the Indiana State Department of Health's WIC program. Part of that program is the people get coupons under the Indiana Farmers Market Nutrition Program.
Mm-hmm.
And they're able to get farmers market produce, but it's only a small portion of what they get through WIC. And I just thought that would be a boon to the farmers markets and local produce if they were free to spend that WIC money. Admittedly, it's not their money, but it's given to them for their food, and if they could just spend it however they wanted.
Let me take that one to Dr. Howell.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Howell.
Some of those rules are created by the United States Department of Agriculture, who actually funds that WIC program. I don't supervise that program, so I don't know all the rules and whatnot, but I know there is a very strong effort on the part of the WIC program to have people utilize the food from farmers markets so that they're able to get fresh produce and eat it. One of the other things that we're working, another area of our department's working is to try to get local produce into schools. We're just exploring that, and I think down the road that may be another way we'll get some local food out there. But go a little back a little bit more about how do we get more local food available is first farmers have to have an incentive to grow it, and that means more than just the farmer's market we got now. We need a way where we can bring a pickup truck load to a farmer's market and sell it in 30 minutes, not sit there and sell it a pound at a time or 6 years at a time. If you're busy producing, you need to be able to move the product very fast, very quickly, and go back to the farm to produce the next batch or to harvest the next batch.
Kiwanis, welcome back to the program. We've got about 30 seconds.
Your question. A quick question.
Okay.
How can I buy fish that's not from China, Argentina, or Asia?
Very quick question. Thank you very much
You're
for
welcome.
Calling back. Tom England.
Yeah,
how can you do that?
That's a really tough question, actually, because if you go to the supermarket, that's what you're going to find. And really, there's no farmers markets that are really carrying fish. We actually have quite a bit of fish being grown here in Indiana through the ponds, basically, that they're growing the fish in. There's just no real clear access to that. I don't know if Tim has more of an answer for that.
Tim, we've got about 30 seconds.
So. Yeah, the quick answer is I don't. But, Growing Power up in Milwaukee has this really interesting model where they have a tilapia, and then the water's recycled, and it helps the nutrients help grow tomatoes and then watercress, and it's this closed-loop system. So that could be the future of aquaponics.
Okay, real quickly, in about 15 seconds, Tom, tell us again about Dig In, where people should go, and what you want them to do.
Sure. Dig In is a great festival that promotes Indiana food and agriculture. You can find more information about the event, the chefs, the lecture series, all at digindiana.org.
I'd like to thank you. This has been a fast-moving hour. I really appreciate the three of you joining us and taking part in the conversation. I'd like to thank Tom England, chef and Ivy Tech's culinary arts instructor, who's also, as you probably could guess, on the Dig In Festival Board. Tom, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dr. James Howell, who is the Assistant Indiana State Health Commissioner. Dr. Howell, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you.
And Tim Carter, I particularly want to thank you for calling in from Montreal and giving up a little bit of time in one of the world's most beautiful cities. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks.
I also would like to thank all of our listeners who helped make this a lively hour, those who called in, those who sent emails and or tweets. Please join us next week when we're going to talk about the reasons that gas prices rise and fall and also take a look at the upcoming political campaign season. I'm John Kroll. Have a good week.
Production of WFYI Radio, 90.1 FM and HD1. Producer, Sharon Alseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each Thursday at noon for No Limits, rebroadcast at 8 p.m. And you can listen online at WFYI.org.